will be restrictions that are put in place that are going to increase the cost for getting those goats here to Alaska, so we will all feel it.
Cook Inlet belugas are listed as endangered. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 17th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, working to head off commercial fishing in Arctic waters.
They're in the process of closing that region to commercial fishing until they know a lot more about the region and would be able to manage that region sustainably.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the new AT&T, your world delivered. Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has determined that the Cook Inlet beluga should be listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The ESA listing means federal agencies that permit or fund activities such as oil, gas, and coal development within the beluga's habitat will have to consult with the National Marine Fisheries Service before proceeding. Brad Smith is a NIMFS biologist. He says industry affecting the waters of Cook Inlet, such as Anchorage's wastewater treatment facility, will have to work with NIMFS before being re-permitted.
If it does not, then there's really no consequence to the consultation. But if we do find that there is an adverse effect, then we would go into what's described a formal consultation with them, where if we found that their activity might jeopardize the continued existence of the Cook Inlet beluga whale, we could come up with a set of conditions that would be required to avoid jeopardizing the animals.
Smith says tissue tests have not revealed many toxins in the belugas, but he says NIMFS will now begin testing for other substances, such as flame retardants. NIMFS biologist Barbara Mahoney says a subsistence harvest plan developed by the Cook Inlet Treaty Tribes spells out no harvest through 2012. She says the review comes in five-year increments.
To determine a harvest level for 2013 through 2017. And that will be based on trends, too. So if you have an increasing trend, then I believe the subsistence harvest increases as the population increases. And it also increases more on an increasing trend than on a stable or a decreasing trend.
Mahoney says surveying the animals will happen on a more frequent basis than the annual surveys that have occurred in the past. Douglas Vincent Lang is the Endangered Species Coordinator for the state's Department of Fish and Game. He says the department has been concerned for a long time about the Cook Inlet beluga population. However, he disagrees with the federal officials over the best way to address those concerns. Vincent Lang says the decision to list them as endangered was premature. He says the state would prefer to see more annual population counts to determine if the increase of recent years will continue.
The population reached a low of about 278 several years ago, and now that those numbers have increased up to about 375 whales. So in the last 4 years, we've seen a 30% increase in the whales. It was our belief when we looked at the information that was available in terms of making this listing decision that the main threat to the whales was unregulated high harvest of whales in the 1990s.
He says the delay between restricting harvest levels and the actual return of the population, about 7 years, is attributed to the time necessary for newborn whales to mature and begin breeding, thus allowing the population to grow. He says delaying a few years would actually provide more data on which to make a decision.
The other piece of this puzzle that's really important to understand how this population is going to respond in the future is to get an index of the number of calves that are out in the inlet. And calf count information has been collected for the past several years, but because of time constraints, that information unfortunately hasn't been able to be analyzed. And we think that that's a critical piece that probably should be analyzed as part of the decision as to whether or not to list this species.
Vincent Lang says the next step in the listing will come in a year with a determination of critical habitat for the species, finished by a recovery plan. He says it is a lot easier to list a species than it is to take it off the protected list. Jason Bruni, the executive director of the Resource Development Council, says the decision will have a major impact on most of the state's residents, citing possible effects on fishing, oil and gas, mining and transportation. As an example, he cites the importance of the Port of Anchorage on the rest of Alaska.
most of the goods that we have go through the Port of Anchorage, and so there will be restrictions that are put in place that are going to increase the cost for getting those goods here to Alaska, and so we will all feel it.
Bruni says his group's major response is to help make changes to the Endangered Species Act to avoid what he sees as an unnecessary listing. Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich is not pleased with the listing. Begich also says the ESA needs changing.
It's over 30 years old, it's outdated, and it needs to understand the new science, but also these subpopulations are, in my view, this kind of ruling focuses on subpopulations, which really I think is not a fair assessment of the beluga overall population, which has been stable.
Begich says he is concerned about possible impacts to port expansion plans and the future re-permitting of the Anchorage wastewater treatment facility. Currently, the sewage treatment plant is required to only provide primary treatment before wastewater is released into Cook Inlet. Begich says the ESA listing could mean the plant would need major renovations.
That cost could be $400 to $600 million, and the ratepayers will have to cover that cost.
Senator Ted Stevens also expressed dismay over the listing today. In a written statement, Stevens says he strongly opposed the listing. He says the decision would substantially delay or halt major development projects within Cook Inlet. Senator Lisa Murkowski also released a statement saying she was disappointed in NOAA's decision to list the belugas. Murkowski stated that although the population is low, it has increased since 2005 and stabilized. She says the decision lacks information regarding seasonal movement and the causes of the long-term decline. Senator Ted Stevens faced intense and critical cross-examination today in court. Alaska's senior senator is on trial for charges of lying about gifts on his financial disclosure forms. He chose to testify on his own behalf, which opened him up to answering the government's questions on the witness stand. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the trial and joins us from Washington. Hi, Libby.
Good evening, Lori.
Libby, what was the tone of the cross-examination today?
It was intense. It started in the afternoon after a long day of direct examination and lasted for about an hour and 15 minutes. It's not over yet. There's more to come on Monday. Prosecutor Brenda Morris started by listing off the alleged gifts, things Stevens said earlier today that he didn't ask for or know about. Morris ran through them. A deck, staircase, gas grill, Christmas lights, sculpture, tools, furniture, and said, if you didn't want any of these items from Bill Allen and they kept showing up at your Girdwood house, why didn't you ask for your house key back? Stephen said he thought about it, but didn't after Allen was injured in a motorcycle accident in 2001. He said they were still friends and Allen was using the Girdwood house more than Stephen's was. It was often a rapid and combative exchange, although Stevens never totally lost his temper. He was very precise and would correct Morris or say he'd already answered her. You could really see his legal training. At one point, he cut her off by saying her question was just tautological, meaning repetitive.
Well, what were the prosecutor's main points in this?
Well, Brenda Morris said to Stevens, okay, so you were the lion of the Senate, but you didn't know how to stop a man from putting items in your home? Well, Stevens said it was a man he trusted. Brenda Morris brought up emails where Stevens thanks Bill Allen for all of his help. And she kept saying Allen was his company, Vico. Vico helped you with your house renovation. How could you say they didn't? And Stevens would just say repeatedly, Allen is his friend, and he saw him as being totally separate from Vico. Allen was just his helpful friend, nothing more. When Stevens kept repeating that he asked for invoices and bills to pay for things, Morris would counter with, okay, so as long as you ask for a bill, you don't have to report it? So she had sort of this skeptical tone that kept coming up during her questioning.
And Libby, what was Stevens' explanation for not following up and actually receiving invoices?
Yeah, that he never knew the bills didn't come in because he assumed his wife, Catherine, was paying them. But Morris tried to point out to the jury that it doesn't all totally add up. In 2002, Stevens found out, after it was already done, that a deck had been put on his house, stairs had been put on his house. A full year earlier, the couple finished paying a contractor. Stephen said today when he saw the extra work, he asked Bill Allen for invoices, not because he thought Allen and Vico were doing the work, but because Allen was the guy collecting and monitoring all of the bills. Stevens said, though, that his wife, Catherine, had nothing to do with the bills at that point regarding the 2002 decks. So it's a little confusing there. So Morris wanted to know, well, why hadn't the bills been followed up on? And he just kept saying, I thought Catherine had paid them. I had no reason to believe Catherine hadn't paid them.
Bill Allen is the government's main witness and testified earlier that Stevens didn't really want invoices but was just covering his tracks.
That's right. And Stephen said today that Bill Allen is a liar. Allen testified that Stevens thanked him for doing extra work on the house more than what the couple paid for. And Stevens today called that a falsehood. Allen also claimed that back in 2006, Stevens said Allen needed to give him invoices to prevent a legal problem and that they couldn't consider the home renovation a gift because they'd run into legal issues. Stevens said today that was an absolute lie. Well, Prosecutor Brenda Morris asked and said, well, are you sure you weren't just covering your butt? Because that's a phrase that's been used a lot in this trial. Well, Stevens shot back that his bottom wasn't bare. Later, Stevens said, if those things were gifts, why would I ask for a bill? You know, you don't ask for a bill when you get gifts. Morris shot back, to cover your butt. And Stevens said, that's not fair, ma'am. So you get that intense, you know, play back and forth between them.
Libby, the trial breaks now for the weekend. What happens next?
Lawyers will meet tomorrow to hash out the instructions that will be given to the jury when they eventually deliberate and figure out what exhibits the jury will consider. But the fireworks between Ted Stevens and Brenda Morris aren't over because there's more cross-examination on Monday. After that, the prosecution will call a few rebuttal witnesses, and then it's time for closing arguments and jury deliberation. And the case will probably go to the jury on Tuesday, just 2 weeks before Stevens faces re-election back home.
All right, Libby, thanks for that update.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
APRN's Libby Casey covering Stevens' trial in Washington, D.C. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hunting from scratch.
Everything I'm using except the powder and the caps that light it off this year, I'll have made it myself.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center opening celebration is October 18th and 19th, featuring big, wild events. Beginning at 10 a.m., free activities for the whole family include live entertainment, an oxygen and octane expo, a street fair along F Street showcasing the new Anchorage Convention District, and Warren Miller Films at the Egan Center. Event information is available online at anchorage.net. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
If climate change results in opening up the Arctic Ocean to shipping, the Arctic could become industrialized, and this worries some environmentalists. Oceana, an international ocean conservation organization, is working to put the far North Seas off limits to fishing. Dr. Chris Krenz is an Arctic project manager with the Juno staff of Oceana, who was at the recent North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting in Anchorage.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is really leading the way and setting what we think is a very wise and prudent example of how to manage industrialization in the Arctic. They're in the process of closing that region to commercial fishing until they know a lot more about the region and would be able to manage that region sustainably.
Right now, there is no commercial fishing in the Arctic, but Krenz says as the climate warms, warm water fish will travel north, and fishermen will not be far behind.
This would close the region to an expansion, but as fish stocks move northwards and fishing fleets move northwards, this puts in place the management framework for the potential of future fisheries, but doing so in a proactive approach instead of letting fisheries develop there and then having a management catch up with the fisheries. This is putting a framework in place that closes the region until there is enough known to manage it for fisheries sustainably without impacting the health of the ecosystem or opportunities for the subsistence way of life.
Kren says fast melting sea ice will allow larger vessels to enter the area, so it's important to put some rules in place now. He says the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's action will help protect the subsistence way of life by keeping fishing boats out until more is known about how industrial fishing interacts with subsistence activities in the region. Kodiak's popular road system deer hunt comes to a close at the end of the month, but those hunters who use primitive weapons will have an extra 2 weeks to take a deer. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
Hank Pennington is the outdoor Kodiak columnist for the Kodiak Daily Mirror. He says the primitive weapon deer season is for those who use bows and arrows, or Pennington's preferred weapon, the muzzleloader.
Picture Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone type guns that instead of using ammunition, you stick into the back of the barrel. The back of the barrel is fixed and closed, and you have to pour the powder down the barrel and then push the bullet down separately, and then you put on some kind of a cap at the back end to fire it, or some guns use actually flint, like the old flint and steel for starting fires. There's a little tiny pan of powder back there, and when you pull the trigger, a piece of flint comes forward and hits the steel and makes sparks and lights the powder. And I don't know how you get more primitive than that.
Pennington says it's his favorite hunt on Kodiak, but it's not for everyone. Over the last 2 years, he's encountered less than 20 people who've participated in the primitive weapon hunt.
You know, just getting your foot in the door is the first step, and then after that, awful lot of hunters have already got their deer on the road system by November 1st, and the final thing is your range is really restricted. You're doing good with a muzzleloader to shoot 100 yards, and 50 yards is more typical, and archery hunters, typically 50 yards would be a long shot, and most of them are restricted to 20 or 30-yard shots.
Another obstacle facing hunters is that they have to take a special class from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in order to participate in the hunt. John Cry is a wildlife biologist with Fish and Game who teaches both classes.
The archery class, we have three archery classes a year. I had two in September, and it's mostly a safety and ethics class for archery hunters. And there's also a proficiency shoot, which archery hunters have to pass to get their card. The muzzleloader class, we're having one next weekend, and I think it's pretty much full. We've got about 25 people signed up so far, but that's a safety and ethics class and teaches you how to break down muzzleloaders. There's a lot of shooting in the class, trying out different loads and projectiles, and it's a lot of fun.
The classes are $20 each. Cry says there's an online version of the archery class, but you have to take the muzzleloader class in person. He says primitive weapon hunts are more popular because they're more sporting and because they provide hunters with added opportunities.
There's a number of hunts all over the state, different moose hunts, and on Kodiak we actually have an archery registration goat hunt on our road system areas. And we also have this extension on the deer season, in which it's the only way actually you can shoot a doe on the road system. So we do have a lot of interest in these classes.
Pennington says he likes hunting with muzzle loaders because it gives him something to do during the off season.
Part of the appeal of muzzle loading, I'll be hunting with a gun I made myself, making the bullets myself. Everything I'm using except the powder and the caps that light it off, this year I'll have made it myself. And so I've been working basically for the last 12 months getting ready for the season. And I get an awful lot of enjoyment outside of the season. It's not just the hunting, it's the making of everything myself.
Kodiak's primitive weapon deer season opens November 1st and runs through the 14th. ADF&G's muzzleloader class is October 24th and 25th. As Cry said, there are only a few spots left, but he's planning to offer another one in the spring. I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This week on AK, we head through the Northwest Passage on a family boat trip and a Coast Guard cutter, plus figuring out who owns what in the Arctic. All that and more this week on AK from APRN.
It may be up to a federal judge to decide whether the Forest Service acted illegally when it investigated and suspended a whistleblower employee on the Tongass National Forest. The employee passed away earlier this year, but his widow wants some answers about the agency's actions. From member station KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein has more on the story.
Glenn Eath was a Forest Service wildlife biologist in Petersburg who successfully challenged some of his employer's timber sale and road building actions. The agency ultimately proposed firing him and suspended him from his job. Eath claimed the Forest Service was retaliating against him for blowing the whistle on illegal road work. Federal law protects whistleblower employees from retaliation. And a federal agency tasked with enforcing whistleblower protections, the Office of Special Counsel, decided to investigate. But the 48-year-old biologist died suddenly of cardiac failure last March. And as a result, the OSC dropped its investigation. Eath's wife, Marquetta, is now pursuing her husband's case.
Glenn did not break any regulations or laws. He openly disagreed with the process, how materials are being presented to the public. And I personally do not believe that sudden death should close the files to Glenn's legal challenges. And I wish to see Glenn's fight for justice to have positive influence on the individuals who decide to speak publicly about issues important to them without being punished. If we can complete Glenn's case, it will have magnificent impact. And nobody will have to go through the ordeal my husband Glenn was put through.
Eath has filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to get the Forest Service to release documents about its actions against her husband. The agency provided hundreds of pages, but withheld hundreds more, claiming some were protected from disclosure by attorney-client privilege, while others were protected as part of the internal deliberations process. The Federal Freedom of Information Act does provide for such exemptions. But FC Director Andy Stahl says those exemptions do not protect documents that were created in the course of illegal activity. And based on what the Forest Service did release, Stahl argues that the agency's actions were clearly retaliatory.
The attorney-client privilege does not apply. If in essence what the attorneys were doing was telling their government clients how to break the law, how to retaliate against Glenn for his whistleblowing.
And Stahl says that's the basis of the lawsuit, which was filed in federal court in Seattle in early October. Eath's suit claims that the Forest Service violated the Freedom of Information Act by improperly denying some of the documents and by failing to respond to her administrative appeal of the regional forester's decision on that. But Stahl says the significance of this case extends beyond the Freedom of Information Act or attorney-client privilege.
This case is actually quite important because this will be the best opportunity, and maybe the only opportunity, to establish first that Glenn was retaliated against, have a court establish that, because that's the first question the court will have to answer. And second, once we get these documents, we'll know who led the retaliation, for sure. We have a pretty good idea now who it is, but we'll have it nailed down. And then we'll try to hold those people accountable for what they did to this whistleblower.
The Forest Service referred questions about this case to the U.S. Department of Justice, which will be defending the agency. An official with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Seattle had no comment this week, as the case is expected to be moved to Anchorage, where it would be overseen by the U.S. Attorney's Office for Alaska. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The Forest Service is moving ahead with plans to sell about 1,000 acres of timber on an island near Wrangell. A new sale will be combined with a previous offering that attracted no bids. Officials say pairing the sales will make logging more economic, but environmental groups say it requires too large of a federal subsidy. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has more details.
What's called the Batu Timber Sale is on Zarimbo Island, which is west of Wrangell, south of Petersburg, and north of Kaufman Cove. Batu, also called Bat, will offer up about 4.5 million board feet of timber to the highest bidder, if there are any. A nearby sale, called Bat 1, failed to attract any bidders earlier this year. Austin O'Brien of the Wrangell Ranger District says that's why the Forest Service plans to offer the sales together.
There's a fair amount of mobilization costs
that a purchaser would incur to get over to the island to move their equipment, et cetera, and set up a camp. So if just from a standpoint of efficiency, it makes sense to combine the two sales together as a single sale.
The Bot 1 and 2 sales encompass about 950 acres and could produce about 20 million board feet of wood. About 14 miles of roads will be built, some permanent and some temporary. The Forest Service plans to advertise the sale in the spring. The Bot 2 sale was approved in June. Four groups appealed: Greenpeace, Cascadia Wildlands Project, the Juneau Group of the Sierra Club, and the Ketchikan-based Tongass Conservation Society. Mark Rorick of the Sierra Club says the sales will hit one of Zorimbo's last roadless areas.
Cutting more on the island is reducing the old growth habitat that deer are dependent on. The Forest Service has refused to use the correct and best scientific data to calculate the habitat capability and to use that in planning their timber sale.
He also says the sale is too expensive. That's largely due to a Forest Service contract already awarded for road construction.
Fiscally, it's a disaster because the Forest Service is spending $2,581,000 to build a road for this sale. And their bid for the advertised timber, their minimum acceptable bid, was $218,000. That's a more than $2 million subsidy.
The Forest Service turned down the group's appeal in September. O'Brien of the Wrangell Ranger District says costs are calculated with more than one sale in mind, so expenses are spread out over time. He also says the agency has done an adequate job of protecting wildlife habitat. The appeal was the final administrative stop for sale critics. The Sierra Club's Rorick says the groups haven't decided yet whether to try to block it in court. The logging industry has its own problems with the Zorimbo Island offerings. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says the first phase was not worth cutting. That was due to its high elevation, poor timber quality, and the lack of infrastructure. He says the combined sales, plus a nearby state offering, could make logging worthwhile. Supply is so short, the region's mills will take any sale seriously. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
A diver who walked off a job in Sandpoint and was missing for 3 days has been found alive and well. 35-year-old John Shannon was working on a dock Tuesday night and told his supervisor he was taking a break. He did not return and was not seen until this morning when he was spotted walking down a street. Jewel says the disappearance triggered a community-wide search that involved people from cannery workers to school children. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Casey Kelly in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage, and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from the Alaska Sea Life Center, Alaska's unique marine research facility and public aquarium. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.